Good morning, everybody. This is Ian Williams, President of the Foreign Press Association. And we thought we had a timely subject, or we invited Professor Alan Lichtman to come and talk to us about the Second Amendment in the wake of all of the shootings. But I think it would be almost remiss not to mention the departure of Boris Johnson in Britain, since we are the foreign press. And since I was the speechwriter for the leader of the opposition many years ago, I would like to point out that Boris Johnson has never uttered a word about abortion, church and state, guns, or any of the other obsessions of the American conservatives, just to put conservatism in perspective, in a mid-Atlantic perspective. But he's gone, and ding dong, I think many people wish that his cis-Atlantic companions went the same way. So we'll discuss Boris Johnson much later on, especially. But today we're returning to the Second Amendment, and Alan's book here is an excellently concise read. I'm not being disparaging. It is small, but it's easy to read, and it's a breathtakingly shocking summary of how the Second Amendment rose from complete obscurity to become a major constitutional obsession, especially with the majority of the present Supreme Court benches, where it's become a benchmark, you might say, of American conservatism and alleged constitutionalism. Well, as Alan will point out, it is almost an entirely a work of fiction in its modern manifestations. What is currently said about it bears no relation to what the NRA used to say about it, what conservatives used to say about it, and what lawyers used to say about it. But we are looking, and it becomes apparent when you read Alan's book, that what we're looking at is a sort of fictive concoction to suit a political end. And we'll discuss with Alan whether it's an actual political end, whether they're really that interested in guns, or whether it's just a fetish of American conservatism to go further. So Alan, tell us, you've dealt with other things in the Supreme Court and the Constitution and the way it's been manipulated by our masters and rulers. But perhaps you could tell us how you got into the book and what gave birth to it.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you how I got into the book. It's a very strange way. And let me preface this by saying, a lot of my best friends said, do not write this book. You're playing right into the hands of the gun advocates by advocating repeal of the Second Amendment. But as I point out in my book, Repeal the Second Amendment, I felt it was a book that had to be written because the current path on which gun control advocates were on was a path to futility. It had been really since the 1990s that we had any significant national gun controls adopted. And I'll talk in a moment about the recent compromise bill in the wake of the recent mass shootings. But I got to it in a very strange way. I was brought up in the inner city, in Brownsville, in Brooklyn, where I learned two things, how to fight and how to run. So not surprisingly, in college, I was on the wrestling team and the track team, but I much preferred running, so I continued to pursue track. But, you know, we fought all the time, but we never got seriously hurt. Why? Because we didn't have guns. If we had guns, I have no doubt that we would have suffered grievous injuries and deaths from the hotheads among us. In other words, guns matter. This notion that, you know, people kill people, but not guns, is propaganda nonsense. It makes a huge difference whether there is the availability of guns. You know, these recent massacres could not have occurred without guns and without these horrific weapons of war, these automatic weapons. And of course, you know, as I grew into a scholar, I began to look at the whole history of the Second Amendment and gun controls. And I'll explain in a moment why the Second Amendment and the notion that it enshrines an individual rights to keep and bear arms is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. But let me begin with a very recent event that you're all very familiar with, sadly, and that's the horrific massacre, of course, the mass shooting in the mall in Denmark. In response, the pro-gun advocate, Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, Republican, said, aha, this proves that gun controls don't work because Denmark has very strict gun controls, and look, they had a mass shooting. Think about it for a moment. Denmark has had one mass shooting with its strict gun controls in the last 7 years. America has had 300 mass shootings in just the first 6 months of 2022. So, you know, this shows the kind of crazy, fictitious, phony arguments that advocates of the gun advocates put forth. And let us understand as well that mass shootings, however horrific and however much they grab our consciousness and hurt our hearts, are the tip of the iceberg of gun violence in America. 15,000 and more gun murders annually in America. About 45,000 gun deaths in America when you count in suicides, accidents. Denmark, if you look at Denmark compared to the United States in terms of gun murders, an American is more than 30 times, not 30%, 30 times more likely to be murdered by a gun than a resident of Denmark.
3,000%, if I'm right.
Yes, exactly. 30 times. And so if we had the same gun murder rate as Denmark, we'd save almost 15,000 lives a year, just from gun murders, not counting suicides and accidents. And Denmark is not an outlier. To listen to the Lauren Boberts of this world, and of course the chief advocate of guns, the National Rifle Association, with our incredibly loose gun control laws, almost nothing at the national level except very ineffective background checks, we should be the safest country of all the advanced democracies of the world. In fact, of course, the opposite is true. Denmark is no outlier. If you compare the United States to the most comparable nations around the world, all of which have very strict gun control regimes, the G7 group of nations plus Australia, an American is more than 20 times, again, not 20%, 2,000% times more likely to be murdered by a gun than a resident of the G7 group of nations, or including Australia. Japan, which has perhaps the strictest gun control laws in the world, they measure their number of murders in the low single digits, even though they have a population about a third the size of that of the United States. So the United States stands out in the worst possible way, not only in terms of mass shootings, but in terms of the number and rate of murders and the number of rate of gun deaths. As I said, if we were comparable to other nations that are our peers, we'd save close to 14,000 murders a year and over 40,000 gun deaths a year. We must not forget that murders are not the full extent of gun deaths in the United States.
So those figures include the notorious cases of police hyper-enthusiasm with firearms?
Yes, absolutely. They do. About 1,000 of those a year. So how do we get here? I'm going to read you a quote from 1955, which says, the Second Amendment involves not an individual right to keep arms, but a collective right to bear arms. This is borne out by both the history of the Second Amendment and judicial decisions. This was not a manifesto of some early gun control group. This was a memo written by the constitutional authority of the National Rifle Association, Jack Basil. And in fact, in its 1975 handbook, the National Rifle Association, and this is not ancient history, reaffirmed that the Second Amendment is pretty much useless with respect to our pursuit of gun rights. So what changed? What changed was the so-called revolution in Cincinnati in 1977, when the National Rifle Association voted in a brand new, highly militant group of leaders, and then made, of course, Charlton Heston, you know, Moses, the great actor, the public face of the NRA, you know, famous for saying, you know, you're going to have to pry my guns from my cold, dead hands. They decided politically, not because there was any new information or new insights about the Second Amendment, they decided politically that the best way to fight gun control and proliferate weapons across the nation was to reanalyze, recast the Second Amendment as enshrining an individual right to keep and bear arms. And they did so by having what I call, what's called law office scholarship. That is scholarship by lawyers, not historians, associated with the NRA to write revisionist phony history about the Second Amendment. And of course, to launch a massive public relations campaign based upon the idea that the Second Amendment enshrines an individual right to keep and bear arms. This was not only done in pursuit of opposition to late 21st century efforts at gun control at the state and national level, but also the NRA became a critical component of the rising American right of the late 20th century. And the gun issue became a hammer, a weapon, if you will, to use against liberals and to support this burgeoning conservative movement, became a critical component of what we today call the culture wars. You cannot separate this Second Amendment hoax with the rise of the American right and its cultural warfare in the late 20th century. And then this phony view of the Second Amendment became enshrined in law after more than 200 years of contrary scholarship and contrary judicial decisions in the 2008 5-4 Heller decision written by Justice Antonin Scalia, enshrining a right to keep and bear arms privately in the Second Amendment for the first time in over 200 years. Just recently, you know, in this new decision, striking down the New York State permit laws, Clarence Thomas, the justice, pro-gun justice, reiterated the idea that the framers were absolutely clear about establishing an individual right to keep and bear arms in the Second Amendment. It's an absolute falsehood. Not a single one of the many hundreds of founders involved in framing, adopting, and ratifying the Second Amendment said that it protected an individual right to keep and bear arms. Not one. They can't point to a single person involved in framing, adopting, or ratifying the Second Amendment that pointed to it establishing an individual right to keep and bear arms. In fact, the Senate didn't record its debates in those days, but if you look at the debates in the House, it was all about the militia. It was all about focused on whether people could of conscience withdraw from their obligations to serve in the militia. And two other quick points. The best window into the thinking of American leaders just prior to the adoption of the Second Amendment were the state constitutions adopted at that time. Of a dozen or so state constitutions, only one established an individual right to keep and bear arms, an outlier. All the rest either were silent on the issue or specifically tied the keeping and bearing arms to collective defense, not to an individual right to keep and bear arms. And here's the clincher. It doesn't cast great light on the framers, but I think it's an absolutely decisive argument. Who framed the Second Amendment? The slaveholder, James Madison. Hundreds upon hundreds of slaveholders in the Congress and in the states voted to adopt or ratify the Second Amendment. Do you think for one moment that these slaveholders would have ratified an amendment that gave Black people an individual right?
Thomas's ancestors, let's get it clear.
Of course not. But you taught, because it was tied to the militia, Black people were barred from the militia, both by state law and by the National Militia Act of 1792. Black people did not become able to join the militia until the period of the Civil War. You know, as sad as that is, I think that's an absolutely decisive refutation, along with everything else, of the idea that the Second Amendment enshrines an individual right to keep and to bear arms. But unfortunately, this hoax has now become embedded among the conservatives on the Supreme Court, which also, I'm not going to get into it, just a whole different topic, also, you know, struck down Roe versus Wade based upon a lot of misreading of American
and history. Voting rights, and there's definitely an agenda if you join the dots.
Exactly. So why do I, you know, against the advice of all of most of my very good friends, wrote a book called Repeal the Second Amendment, The Case for a Safer America. Because I looked at the gun control movement and saw that it was based upon an impossibly self-defeating and weak argument. The argument was, we support the Second Amendment, but, which plays right into the hands of the Second Amendment radicals and the hoax about the Second Amendment enshrining an individual right to keep and bear arms. It's a tactic that got the gun control movement nowhere. You know, at the time I wrote this book a couple of years ago, nothing had happened on the national level since the 1990s, and the Supreme Court, you know, had already fundamentally chipped away at the notion of gun control, making us so much safer. So my idea was the game had to be changed. There had to be a new approach that could inspire and revitalize a gun control movement. And that's why I talked about the repeal of the Second Amendment. I'm not naive. I fully understand the difficulties of passing a constitutional amendment to repeal or modify the Second Amendment. I'm well aware of the difficulty of gaining two-thirds of both houses of Congress and ratification by three-quarters of the states. But I did at least believe that a movement for it, a push for it, could revitalize the gun control movement. And I was inspired as well by the late Justice John Paul Stevens, who I think it was in 2018, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times advocating the repeal of the Second Amendment. John Paul Stevens is a Republican appointee on the Supreme Court and certainly no wild-eyed radical. And if John Paul Stevens could be advocating this, it certainly could not be that far-fetched. And I note that there is precedent for repealing a constitutional amendment, and it happened in the course of only about 14, 15 years or so, and that was the repeal of the Prohibition Amendment. Why was the Prohibition Amendment repealed? Because people, including initial supporters of the amendment, like the great industrialist philanthropist John D. Rockefeller, believed that it had become counterproductive, that it was making the nation less safe and not achieving its goals, which is exactly what the current construction of the Second Amendment is doing. And although I didn't have before me the current decision of the Supreme Court striking down the New York State permit laws, I warned that as long as you have the Second Amendment and this Heller decision and then followed up by a decision applying it to the states, that even if you got effective national gun control, the Supreme Court may well strike it down. There's no protection for the any kind of gun control measures. And also, you know, this whole notion that weak gun controls keep us safe is not only belied by the international statistics I've told you, but by what the statistics are of the United States. There are six states that have this strict gun permit regime that New York State has, six states. And these permit regimes were struck down by the Supreme Court. The gun death rate in those six states, according to the most recent statistics by the Centers for Disease Control in the US, was 6.6 per 100,000. In the remaining states, the death rate was 16.3 per 100,000, almost triple. New York State, the state that had its laws struck down, the death rate was 5.3%. Of all the gun control measures, strict permit laws are the most effective, and the Supreme Court just said, forget it, based upon a fraudulent view of the Second Amendment. Now, after 30 some odd years, we finally got a new compromise gun control measure after the most recent rounds of horrific mass killings. And there were some useful things in there, controls on abusive boyfriends, not just husbands, controls on some straw purchases, expanded background checks for under 21, encouraging red flag laws. But the truth is, you know, this will make no impact whatsoever upon mass shootings or the proliferation of gun murders and gun deaths. It's just nowhere near comprehensive enough. But sadly, it may convince politicians, oh, we've done enough. You know, we've adopted this national regime, even though it is so weak. What we really need is strict gun permit laws, bans on assault weapons, which have only one purpose, killing large numbers of people in minutes. You can fire off dozens of rounds, as we've seen in these mass shootings, from an AR-15, a semi-automatic rifle, in a minute. Banning high-capacity magazines. Why does anyone need to be able to shoot 50 rounds in a minute except to engage in mass shootings? Controls over so-called ghost guns, self-made, unregistered guns, gun safe storage laws. That kind of comprehensive set of laws, like those that virtually every other democracy has. You know, we stand out as an outlier, would make a real difference, which is why I say we have to revitalize the gun control movement. And the only way to do that is with a push to repeal the Second Amendment and peel away the hoax that's been perpetrated on the American people. I'm now happy to take any and all questions.
I was struck as part of my expertise as a historian is in alcohol and rum. So prohibition, one of the several of the theses about the repeal of prohibition are that some moneyed interests were persuaded that the repeal of that was necessary to repeal income tax, because income tax was introduced to make up the revenue that was lost from banning of alcohol taxes.
Money talks and number walks. And that's what we need. So
the contemporary equivalent of the Koch brothers decided that they get rid of prohibition in return for abolishing the income tax. Luckily, the first half worked, the second half
didn't. Quite get there.
I'll drink to that, but that's another story. But, you know, this comprehensive rewriting of history is horrifyingly Orwellian. I mean, you mentioned that we now have an invented history, and we mentioned it, it might not be the one to conjure with, but I can understand why people will caution you against writing it, because somebody else who wrote something similar, Michael Belzile, I read his book. It was reviewed very favorably by Gary Wills in the New York Times. And the lobby piled in on him and basically made him a non-person.
The lobby,
not because of the
ruthless
substance of his arguments, but you know, that they picked on every possible thing they could do. You know, whether he cut his toenails before going to bed so that they could make him a non-person out of him and destroyed his career, as far as I can see.
Oh, they completely destroyed his career for entirely self-serving purposes. The lobby is corrupt. Let me repeat that. The NRA is corrupt. It has been sued successfully. And what the NRA is, it's a money funneling operation. And where does the money go? It goes to its CEO and its high officials who make hundreds of thousands of dollars and get far more in perks. While the ordinary employees of the NRA are basically getting stiffed. It's a way of extracting money from true believers and then funneling that money into its leadership. Not surprisingly, there was a revolt against that within the NRA itself. And the NRA is, you know, it had to move out of New York. It had to declare bankruptcy, is in real trouble. Yet still people believe that this organization is for real. It's a racket.
I should alert people, if you have any questions, you can put them in the chat or in the Q&A, and we can pick up from there. But what would be the moves to repeal the Second Amendment? And I mean, apart from the legalistic moves, the real issue here is, as I think you mentioned it before, that the silent majority are silent. And a very vociferous armed minority is getting its way. What mechanisms could you suggest that would get people riled up enough? I mean, you know, how many mass shootings does it take for people to say, up with this, we will not put, and to put some force behind it?
It is incredible. You know, it's not just the 300 mass shootings this year. It's, you know, hundreds, thousands of mass shootings ever since Sandy Hook, the massacre of the school children some 20 years ago, some 10 years ago. What I suggest in the book is, as with the repeal of the prohibition, you need converts. You need, just like John D. Rockefeller, you need those who believe in gun rights. And by the way, repealing the Second Amendment does not mean you get your guns confiscated. For over 220 years or so, the Second Amendment was not interpreted as providing an individual right to keep and bear arms, and no one's guns were confiscated. It simply opens the way to reasonable gun controls like universal background checks, permit laws, bans on assault weapons. So you need converts, those who, you know, are gun owners and who believe in responsible gun ownerships to turn around. You need money, as you say. Business has got to be convinced that mass murders and 45,000 deaths a year is not good for American business. And then you need new grassroots organizations. One of the great failures, and I think it goes to this, we believe in the Second Amendment, but kind of thing, is the failure to generate real grassroots movement behind gun control, or in my case, repeal of the Second Amendment. You know, how did we get the Civil Rights Act? It was a combination of leaders like Lyndon Johnson on the Democratic side, Everett Dirksen on the Republican side, and a massive grassroots civil rights movement. You need that combination. And amazingly, we haven't seen it. And you'll never see it so long as the rallying cry is, we support the Second Amendment, but that will inspire no one.
Do any of the current crop of billionaires strike you as particularly amenable on this subject? With the possible exception of Warren Buffett, they all look like dyed-in-the-wool conservatives.
Well, Michael Bloomberg has certainly been, you know, he's, you know, God knows how many tens of billions he's worth. He has certainly been in the forefront of the movement to not necessarily repeal the Second Amendment, but at least in the forefront of the movement for gun control. And we have in very recent years, just in the last 3 or 4 years, seen a movement of the money that I think in 2018, maybe for the first time, there was more money being spent on the gun control side than on the NRA side. So there has been some movement. And as you say, you know, Warren Buffett, Michael Bloomberg are prime examples of some of the richest people in the world who have, you know, who have come down to the right side of this.
But it's amazing how that, well, certainly with Bloomberg and say Soros, they are the archetypes who will produce an outburst of hissing in any conservative forum.
George Soros, you know, Holocaust survivor, has been the target of the most vituperous, the sleaziest, the most outrageous attacks on the left. And not just from fringes, from major Republican figures accusing Soros of paying anarchists to riot, of paying Black people to start a race war, of being the embodiment of evil. You know, you go out there and you advocate things that rile up the American right, and you're putting yourself in the crosshairs. Adam Kinzinger, you know, one of the two Republicans on the January 6th committee, just released the horrible, awful, profane, scurrilous threats that he's received just for doing his job as a member of Congress. And, you know, so the violence of guns spills over into the what I call the violence of the political rhetoric coming from the far right.
There's, Simon Locke is suggesting about when journalists are covering the Second Amendment, what's the simplest version of the reading of it that undermines the individual right to bear arms? Yeah, I mean, it's a very convoluted piece of, yeah. They weren't grammarians, the people who wrote that, were they?
The first reference, of course, in the Second Amendment is to support a well-regulated militia. Then the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be abridged. If they simply meant to give an individual right to keep and bear arms, they wouldn't have to refer to the militia at all, would they? Because a broad individual right to bear arms is much broader than the right to bear arms in support of a militia. It would include Black people. It would include women. It would include underage people. It potentially could include Native Americans. All of these groups that the framers had no intention of allowing to keep and bear private arms. And so you've got to focus on the first clause of the Second Amendment, which would be totally superfluous if it simply meant to provide a universal individual right to keep and bear arms to all the people of the country.
It was interesting. Frank Gomez says, what role can media play to expose the NRA? He wants to know. And it just occurred to me when I told you last night, I got an email from somebody saying, are we putting the other side on? Why are we just putting one side? And I said, well, you know, Well, when we deal with space flights, we don't necessarily put the Flat Earth Society on. So, I mean, to what extent do you think we're caught up with the spurious idea of balance that some would-be liberal journalists have, that they have to put both sides? And when is it time, like with climate control, to say, there isn't another side. This is a farrago. We're not going to give it time except to expose and denounce it. Should journalists get off their perch and do this, do you think?
I have said many times in many forums, if there were two words I would abolish from the English language, those two words are both sides. As you say, there is truth and there is falsehood. And falsehood does not stand in equal measure with truth. And, you know, I do function both as an historian, as, you know, and as a commentator in the public realm, both through broadcast and writing. And there isn't both sides, as you say, on issues like climate change and guns. And I've always thought the role of the media is to find truth, not to simply take the easy road out and say, you know, this is what one side says and this is what the other side says. We've seen the same thing with the big lie about the so-called stolen election of 2000, which we know is, you know, a complete hoax, a complete falsehood. And eventually the media did come around to that and did get off of the both sides. But on critical issues like climate change and guns, they need to do the same.
Yeah, and I mean, it's the ghost of the so-called fairness doctrine that's been abandoned everywhere.
It would appear. Yeah, I mean, we eliminated that in the 1980s.
Yes. I mean, it's a journalistic commitment. I think my commitment is to the truth, not to the balance. If people want to have their say, they're welcome to. But Frank Gomez says, what role can the media play to expose the NRA in credible fashion? Seems that what has been reported has little effect. And I was thinking, when you look at the, how should we put it, the expose of Wayne Pierre and the depredations that him and his henchmen did on the funds of the NRA, and the dubiousness of the, you know, of the legal 501c3 status of the organization.
Oh, it's a complete fallacy.
Why isn't it? Why do you think the media hasn't played a bigger role in it? Is it because they're scared of getting beaten up like you or Michael Belzeal? Why aren't they? Why isn't this front page news?
It should be front page news because it affects the health and safety of every American. You know, we spend all this time on these mass shootings trying to figure out, why did these people do this? And I have to tell you, that's a rat hole. You're never going to figure out why these people engage in mass shootings. There's no common denominator. You know, this notion, oh, it's a mental health problem. That's a calumny on people suffering mental health issues. Tens of millions of people have mental health issues in this country. All these other nations, which have minuscule gun murder rates compared to the United States and very rarely have mass shootings, they all have mental health issues comparable to that of the United States. So there are all of these red herrings, you know, that are thrown in the path of understanding gun deaths and gun murders in America. And the media needs to cut through that. There's only one common denominator that separates us from the rest of the advanced democratic world. And one common denominator that separates states like New York from states like Texas, and that is guns. And the media needs to come to understand that and come to understand what a corruption the NRA is and how to pad their own pockets and preserve their own power, they put all of us in jeopardy.
To what extent, though, is it a sort of gun saturation? Because I understand, I mean, gun ownership is quite high in Canada, but psychosis, endemic psychosis, finishes at the border. Could you explain the dichotomy?
Well, I'm not deeply familiar with the intricacies of Canadian laws, but I do think they're quite a bit stricter than those in the United States, with much more controls over guns. It's both the fact that it's so easy to get these deadly weapons. And it's not just, gun advocates say, but it's the law-abiding citizens who have guns. And I have no problem with law-abiding citizens having guns. The problem is the laws are so loose that anyone can so easily get a gun. And it has to be at the national level. You know, one of the studies I did in my book, Repeal the Second Amendment, was to look at guns confiscated at the scene of a crime. And what you find is that the guns that are confiscated are vastly more likely to come from states without tight gun control laws than they are from states with tight gun control laws. So, you know, if you live in Maryland, you've got, you know, a pretty tight gun control regime. You know, go a few miles to Virginia, and, you know, it's a very different situation. Live in Illinois, go next door to Indiana. That's why you need a national solution. Yes, individual state laws can make a big difference, but most states don't have strict laws, and guns easily cross state lines.
Well, Rupert Shaw asked if governors of any state have executive authority to ban assault weapons, but I was wanted to take that a bit further. Do you think there's a possibility of a demonstrative definition of states' rights, where the governor of New York has patrols and barriers on the bridges and tunnels, searching traffic coming in from Florida and other places and searching for contraband weapons?
Well, you know, that might be a way of at least reducing, but I don't think the state, even as rich as New York is, the state of New York has the resources to control every point of entry into the state, which of course is massive. You know, for all the effort state and federal governments do to control the flow of drugs, totally ineffective. You know, that kind of solution, you know, is the fallacy behind how many trillions have we spent to no end in the war on drugs.
It's up there. But I mean, that also exposes the difficulties of prohibition. I come from Britain, where I was in a pistol club and I had a permit. Sure. And after the mass shooting there a few years ago, they just banned pistols. If you're in a pistol club, if you're the Olympic pistol team in Britain has to fly out the country to practice, because it's literally illegal to have a pistol club or to hold pistols in private hands. I think was a bit of an overreaction, but I'm prepared to suffer for it. So to some extent, that put truth in the room as the NRA is spreading, and it's obviously helped in Britain, but the firearms are still available, but restricted, and it makes it very difficult to get hold of.
Yeah, firearms murders in Britain are vastly lower than in the United States, as are firearms deaths. It's not the lowest. I think Japan probably has the lowest, but it's way lower than that in the United States.
There are technological suggestions that have been made over time, that sort of time-expired ammunition time-expired firearms. Is this feasible?
Yeah, one, I think, useful technological solution, and I'm no technologist, but is to individualize your firearm so only you can fire it. So if it's stolen or you give it to someone else, you know, a lot of the firearms used in crime are stolen. You know, this notion, the law-abiding citizens, no problem. There's huge amounts of stolen weapons from gun stores and so-called law-abiding citizens. But if you have these trigger controls, it would make stealing guns or trading for guns, which is another huge black market in trading for guns, pretty much useless, and would substantially reduce accidental gun deaths. So I think that's one technological solution that I would favor. But of course, the gun lobby and the gun manufacturers, that's anathema to them.
Well, what about another solution that's been put about is the idea of insurance, compulsory insurance. Anyone who buys a firearm has to take out, if you're driving a vehicle, you have to take out insurance on the contingency that other people might be injured, even if you're not direct cause. So what about loading up the costs of gun deaths onto the guns and making this a compulsory insurance on every gun that's purchased?
I kind of like that idea. The problem is that has economic discrimination. That is, it enables those with resources to get guns and those who lack the resources not to get guns. So I do think there is an issue there. But you know, that those
it kinds doesn't worry of the police about insurance. They're very happy to lock up poor drivers who can't afford insurance.
Exactly.
They can lock up poor gun owners who can't afford insurance.
You know, another crazy thing that it was one of the leaders in Congress as well, one of the Republicans, who said, look, you know, airplanes were used in the 9/11 mass killings, but we're not banning airplanes. Well, airplanes have a use, you know. Guns are only useful for wounding and killing, particularly automatic weapons. But my biggest response was, absolutely, if we regulated firearms to the extent we regulate airplanes and air traffic, we'd solve the problem.
But even, I mean, when you look at it, I saw libertarians answering questions in, I think it was Wyoming yesterday, about the iniquity of the state licensing people to drive automobiles.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, that's how far we've gone, that they really do not see that the state should have any role at all, that anybody who wants to buy a tank and roll it down the street who can't steer is perfectly entitled to. It's their right as a citizen, and it's the same with guns.
But the state should be patrolling women's bedrooms, right? And forcing women to carry pregnancies to term. But, you know, we can't force people to wear masks or, you know, get driver's license. You know, the contradictions and hypocrisies in this are, you know, thick enough to cut with a butter knife.
That's a nice one. It's a very sharp knife that they're covering, yes. Unfortunately, if we can pursue the metaphor. There are no quick fixes, are there? I mean, we have to talk about a societal revolution, but I mean, especially with the politics here, because you mention it, and the more I read it, round about the time of the Reagan Revolution, when they put in, when they started packing the NRA, is the same time they started packing the state courts and the federal courts, and moving the whole agenda, social agenda, the way people think, to the right. And it's been a very successful enterprise. You know, the idea, when I was a kid, it was taken as axiomatic. The state would look after people in their old age and when they were ill. I mean, I'm from Britain as well, of course, we actually did it. But even in Britain now, that's been so eroded by this conservative neoliberal wave. So it's similar with the gun control. Most people are going to pay lip service, as you say, to the Second Amendment. What ways can we confront not just this particular issue, but the whole general conservatization of conservatism that's afflicted the society, the selfishness that's afflicted the society?
You put your finger on something very, very important, and that is the right has been vastly more successful than the left in perpetrating these new historical, cultural, political views on the country. You see it, of course, in the anti-abortion movement, the anti-abortion decision. You see it in the gun control decision. You see it in decisions on separation of church and state. And you see it now in laws being passed at the state level, state of Florida, state of Texas, for example, imposing a conservative perspective on teaching. You can't teach anymore in these states unless you parrot a conservative view of American history. So they're going right to the core, right to the cause, to what our kids are being taught in schools. And the left, or even the mainstream, I don't even call it the left, the mainstream has been asleep when it's come to this. And they need to wake up and be just as ruthless and as single-minded as the right. You know, how did we get the Roe decision? Because ruthless Mitch McConnell wouldn't even give a hearing to an eminently qualified appointee for the Supreme Court of Barack Obama, Merrick Garland. And McConnell has said, if Republicans take control of the Senate, we're not going to confirm any Supreme Court nominees from the president. So they don't care about the Constitution. They don't care about right or wrong. They only care about power, and the Democrats are way behind. I've said you can explain American politics in four words: immoral Republicans, spineless Democrats.
I'll drink to that as well. There are two other questions that are coming up, and we haven't got that
much time. Sure, and then I'll need to go.
Sure. One is on the question of the police, the attitude of the police. You'd assume that in general, the police are would be against something that when these guns are out there, it's the police are often the targets.
Yes.
And yet, there's an ideological switch in the police where they are advocating the right for people to carry arms and shoot at them, it would appear.
Yeah. And we've had not just horrific mass shootings recently, we've had horrific shootings of police, policemen and women. And then again, another contradiction on the right. You know, we're the party, we're pro-police, we're for law and order, except when it doesn't serve our interests. We couldn't care less about 140 police who were seriously injured and a few who died in the January 6th insurrection. Oh, that was just a tourist visit, no problem. We couldn't care less about the proliferation of guns that endanger our police. But again, because the right is ruthless, they don't care to be intellectually consistent.
Well, Jonathan Capstein has pointed about the ideological wrapping of this package, that gun control has been wrapped into a whole sort of libertarian defense against the encroachments of the state. And it comes back to what we're saying. How can we combat that? Because nobody's advocating... well, some people are, but the opponents of gun violence are talking about normal restrictions. They've been asking for the normal restrictions that you would inflict on somebody who wants to drive, a highly dangerous piece of machinery through the streets that risks people's lives.
Less restrictive even than the restrictions on driving.
Yeah. Yes. Well, as we've seen, some people are opposed even to that. But can we get a campaign that points out this, that you get insurance for a car, get insurance for a gun, you get tested for driving, get tested for a gun license?
Yes, you know, we need to normalize this. And that has been the big failure of the gun control advocates. And we'll never normalize it as long as we're saying we support the Second Amendment. But that takes us right into the hands of the gun advocates. Until we begin to expose, and it's going to take some courage to expose this, because the right has been so successful in the last 50 years of enshrining the Second Amendment on the same plane as the First Amendment. For example, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of, you know, to bear and keep arms is on the same level, even though that's a preposterous view of history. So we need to expose and unpack the Second Amendment. Otherwise, we're never going to normalize gun control.
Well, I think we're coming to the end of it now before the NRA finds out where we are and we get a missile strike on us. I can see there's a clear target from my window here. I'd like to thank you, Alan. This has been a good exposition of, because it's a more complex, the society is complex because it's ruled by very simplistic people.
A minority. You know, we have minority, yes, rule. And part of that is, you know, we're the longest continuous democracy, and that's great. But we're stuck with a lot of 18th century institutions, like the Electoral College, like Montana having the same number of senators as
New York and California. Yeah.
So we're set up for minority rule, unfortunately.
No, I mean, I always clearly see that the US Constitution is basically the British 18th century Constitution continued by other means. And
yes.
I think one great 18th century historian in Britain said the purpose of politics was to get your supporters elected and then reward them.
Pretty much.
And that seems to be the perfect description of American democracy as we know it. But thank you very much, everybody. This is Ian Williams from the Foreign Press Association. We've been speaking to Alan Lichtman about the Second Amendment, repealing of. And we also got to announce for our next briefing, reporting from Kyiv with Dania Shevchenko, who is the chief executive of the Kyiv Independent. And if ever there's a place that calls for gun control, of course, it's Ukraine at the moment. And we really should stop Putin importing those weapons across the border. And I hope that you, I hope you've enjoyed this. If you do any studies based on it, let us know. Do join the Foreign Press Association. If you have ideas for future briefings, timely ones, do let us know. And we will try to accommodate. And once again, thank you very much for Alan, to Alan.
Read my book. Read my book. There's so much more in it.
The book. It's all there. And it's succinct. It's readable. It's I got it yesterday and I finished it this morning. You've cost me a day, Alan, but it was worth it.
Well, you could spend your day, you know, profitably.
Okay. But thank you very much. And do
keep
in touch.
Thank you.
Let us know if you have any thoughts on impending future events. We'd be happy to publicize them. And any articles you have, we'll similarly send them out to our members.
Thank you. I'll send you my most recent article called The Second Amendment Hoax.
Do that. Great. Thank you very much, everybody. I'll see you again soon, I hope.